Let's get going. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us on episode two of our Employment 101 series three. The theme for this year, if you joined us last week, you will know, is in relation to the cost of living crisis and economic uncertainty. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment Law and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England, but we work with companies who are based all over the world, and they have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's how we help them. As always, I am delighted to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, everybody.
And we have got a good session today where we are looking at what the main political parties are talking about in terms of employment rights and effectively what could change if we have a government change. Before we get into that, just a couple of housekeeping matters. For those of you that have joined before, you'll know we record these sessions. So if you want to dip into them later, either looking at the video, you can do so on our website. If you want to look in at the audio and have a listen, we're on Spotify and Apple Music, I think it is, and all good podcast providers. So you can listen to our session today at your pleasure and all of the other sessions, of which there are now many that are online. So please do check those out. So we have had the party political season, just finishing off with the Labour Party conference recently. We wanted to have a chat to you really just about some of the things that could be coming online. We're obviously all expecting a general election some point next year. I think it has to be done by January 2025, absolutely latest. If the current opinion polls are anything to go by, it is looking like there is going to be a change of government, but obviously there's a long time to go potentially before a general election. Labour have been the most vocal in terms of setting out their agenda so far as employment rights are concerned. So there is a little bit of crystal ball gazing today. We're curious to know if you've got any thoughts as well that you want to share. As always with these sessions, if you want to ask some questions, just use the Q&A function. We'll try and deal with them as we go along. If you want to chat to anybody else, make any general comments for the wider group, use the chat function at the bottom as well. So getting into it, I'm just going to talk about a few proposed changes in terms of trade union rights. Now, as a firm, we've probably done more trade union related work in the past 10 months, so since the turn of the year, than at any time in the last sort of 10, 15 years, actually. And, you know, really that has to be influenced by the cost of living crisis and, you know, more engagement with unions in terms of unions being vocal about pay negotiations, which seem to have been harder work this year, and some unions looking for recognition in workplaces where they haven't previously had recognition as well. So there's been a lot of union activity going on. What are Labour saying about this? Well, they've got three proposed kind of main areas that they're saying they're going to look at. Now, this information we're talking about all comes from, well, primarily what Angela Rayner has been saying, first of all, at the Trade Union Congress in September, and more recently at the Labour Party conference on the 8th of October. Her speeches are published online, so you can go on the Labour website and check them out. And Angela Rayner is, of course, Shadow Secretary for Levelling Up and Housing. I think she's got quite a wide brief. When it comes to trade union activity, the first thing that Labour are saying is they want to simplify the statutory recognition process. And they're saying they want to do that for two things. They want to help the gig economy and people who are employed in the gig economy. And typically we're talking about people in app-based roles. And they also want to help remote workers organise better as well. Obviously, since COVID, we've seen this massive explosion in remote working, hybrid working, non-traditional working patterns. And I think Labour have identified that maybe there's a weakness there in terms of helping employees actually be able to organise. So they're saying they want to help this statutory recognition process. Now, for those of you that don't have any experience of working in a unionised environment, the normal process for a trade union to get recognised is initially to come to the employer and say, hey, we're this trade union. We think it will really benefit your employees if you recognise us officially, which means that you then negotiate with us on things like pay and hours of work and holiday. Let's have a negotiation. Let's try and get a recognition agreement in place. There's some to and fro in negotiation on that. And ultimately, if voluntary recognition happens, your workplace, your company enters into a non-legal agreement with the trade union that sets out the rules. It's kind of like a contract, I suppose, though it's not legally binding. Now, of course, there are situations where unions approach an employer and say, hey, we'd like to do that. And the employer says, no, thanks, that's not for us. And maybe it's because the employer just doesn't want to engage with the union. Maybe it thinks that the union doesn't have that groundswell of support within the workforce that the union thinks it has. In those situations, there's a statutory recognition process. So there's like a very formulaic process that unions have to go to where they effectively will force through recognition. Now, obviously, they need to be able to demonstrate things like a certain minimum of support, but ultimately, it goes to a central arbitration committee and they will force, union if these trigger points are met. The significant thing about statutory recognition is that it's only in relation to pay, hours, and holiday. So voluntary recognition is better for unions often because the scope of what they will negotiate on is broader. But under statutory, it's just pay, hours, and holidays. Labour are saying we're going to simplify that. We're going to strip away some of those hurdles that unions have to jump through in order to force through recognition. So, what could that mean potentially? Well, maybe more workplace recognition. There may be more employers that are having, they're forced to recognize trade unions, which ultimately means having to have an engagement strategy with trade unions. We're not commenting on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. No doubt you'll have your own views on that, but it's something that Labour will be pushing for. The second thing that Labour are talking about relevant to trade unions is giving a new legal right to access workplaces. So obviously that's tied up with recognition. The way it works at the moment is obviously individuals who are in disciplinary and grievance situations have a statutory right to be accompanied, and that statutory right extends to a trade union representative. And quite a common question we get is, oh, Joe Bloggs, he's coming along to a disciplinary. He's asked to bring along his trade union rep, but we don't recognise a trade union. So, do we have to let that person accompany them? The answer is yes. It isn't contingent on the workplace, the employer actually recognising a trade union for an individual to be able to exercise their rights. If they're a member of their own trade union, they pay their subs. Doesn't matter if that trade union is not recognised by your business, the individual still has a right to be accompanied by that person. So there's a kind of right of access there in terms of accompaniment to those sorts of processes. There's also right of access in terms of assistance when you're looking at things like collective redundancy exercises as well. So any of you that have been through a collective redundancy process, certainly where a trade union is involved, it's commonplace to set aside those facilities to give the trade union the ability to access their representative group. But apart from that, there's no other wider right to union access into the workplace. And I know historically, when you look at some companies, maybe Amazon, maybe McDonald's, comments that they've made about union access, not every employer is going to be thrilled about the idea of having to give up some type of access to its employees to trade union groups. So it remains to be seen what detail Labour are going to come up with there about that right of access, but it is something that that potentially is going to change. I'm just looking at your question, Elaine. Thanks for that. What's the what is the company? What if the company policy states, I think, that the employee can be accompanied by a recognised trade union official? I mean, if a company policy says that, then obviously you're not going to want to go against your own published policy because it opens you up for criticism. So, quite common. It is quite common for policies to reflect that right to be accompanied. The third and final provision in relation to trade unions that Labour are talking about is quite a controversial one. It relates to the laws that came in July 2023, so earlier in the summer, and that's in relation to the anti-trade union laws. So for those of you that don't know, the change that came in at the start of the summer was in relation to the Strikes Minimum Service Levels Act. And that was all about providing for minimum service levels to be implemented in relation to strike action in relevant services. So things like health, transport, education, fire and rescue, border control, nuclear decommissioning, and radioactive waste management. Appreciate those last two are pretty niche. We've all seen the news headlines. We know what's been happening over the 12 months in terms of different strike action. We know about the NHS strike action and nurses, junior doctors, consultants on the picket lines. The government clearly were unhappy with all of that, and they have implemented legislation to say, look, we don't think it's fair that people in those particular industries are able to strike. So we're going to effectively mean that there has to be minimum service levels provided for during strike periods. So effectively, there's some people still need to work to provide that minimum level of cover. Now, why that's problematic for a number of people is that it brings into conflict with one of the fundamental human rights, which is a right to strike. You know, if you're an employee, kind of the ultimate control you've got or an ultimate sanction you've got or power is to withdraw your labor from your employer and say, no, I'm refusing to come into work. And this minimum service level legislation restricts that because it forces some people to provide that cover. And that's why it's so contentious. Labor are saying, it's outrageous. We're going to repeal it, and we're going to do so within the first 100 days of office if we get in. So that may or may not impact on your business, but it'll certainly impact on you as an individual if you are a user of the health service, or you know, there's some incident where fire and rescue is needed, for example.
Or if you have to take a day off because your kids can't go to school.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, in terms of teaching. Yeah, of course, education. Yes, which is obviously really going to antagonize the teaching unions, has antagonized the
Yeah.
teaching unions. Sorry, I've just seen the clarification on the question that was asked before. So the question is, can an employee be accompanied by a trade union official if the policy states they can only be accompanied by a trade union recognized by the company? So no, I think if the policy says you can only be accompanied by a trade union recognized by the company, I don't think that can override your statutory right to be
Yeah.
accompanied by a trade union rep of your choice. So if the company recognizes, I don't know, Unite, for example, but the individual employee is a member of a different union that isn't recognized by the company, the individual employee can still say, I want to be accompanied by a union rep from the union that I'm a member of, irrespective of that being recognized by the company.
Yeah, I think the point there is that it's a statutory right, and it actually only applies to disciplinary and grievances, which a lot of people forget. I mean, a lot of companies, by best practice, allow companions into things like redundancy meetings, but that's not technically covered. So if you do have policy which says that the employee can only be accompanied to disciplinary or grievance meetings by somebody who from a rep from a trade union re that's recognised by the company, you're actually limiting the statutory rights. Which
And
you shouldn't be doing.
Maria said it has to be a real union, right? And yes, it does have to be. It does have to be a real union. And it's a good question because I have seen people kind of try and fake stuff as a means to bring along their, I don't know, cousin who happens to be an employment lawyer or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, there, I
Yeah.
forget the exact requirements, but you can ask for evidence of certification. But it
Yeah.
doesn't need to be a real union, and you are entitled to ask reasonable questions to try and establish that.
But there are a whole bunch of bodies out there. I've had this quite a lot recently, where there are lots of independent unions that specifically offer to employees the chance to be accompanied at meetings. And very often you'll get an email saying, right, here's the certification of the union. Here's my own personal certification. I'm a trade union rep. The employee is a member, and I want to come along. And that's perfectly fine. Well, it's perfectly fine for the employee. And unfortunately, as an employer, you have to allow that to happen.
Go along with it. I mean, generally, in my experience, it normally just rubs along. I mean, I've encountered probably a couple of occasions where the employers reported back, we had this trade union person in, and they were just really awkward and difficult to deal with. But I suppose that could be the case for someone just being accompanied by another colleague who could be, you know, that way
Yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
Adrienne. Yeah.
So shall I carry on with the sort of the large scale changes that Labour are proposing? So one
Yeah,
of the big
please.
things they're talking about is really boosting the rights for all workers, employees. And one of the major things they're talking about is introducing day one rights. And I think they had it under the headline of people should have full employment rights. Now, everyone means by full, it's a little bit unclear at the moment because we don't have that much detail. But at the moment, as most of you will know, there's several rights that require a minimum service. For example, the statutory pay for maternity, adoption and shared parental leave, the right to request flexible working, that all requires 26 week service. So the proposal is that would go, and there's an entitlement to that type of pay and access to flexible working from day one. But also, Labour have previously said that they would make unfair dismissal protection a day one right. And Angela Rayner said in her speech that there would be an exemption for probationary periods. Now, this is massive, obviously. Now, when I first started practising many years ago, the qualifying service was 2 years. It then dropped down to 1 year for a short period of time, and now it's back at 2 years. But if that's going to be a day one right, employers will have to think, well, how is that going to impact on you? So just certain things to think about. It will mean that your recruitment processes will have to be an awful lot tighter because, you know, now it's a case of we'll take somebody on, we'll put them through a probationary period. But even then, we've got 2 years to see if they work out. Now, you know, if you're talking about having to go through all the statutory processes for performance management, et cetera, from day one, I think that recruitment is going to be brought into sharp focus. If there's an exemption for probationary periods, is there a possibility to make them longer? I mean, I think the only thing I would say to that is people tend to write probationary periods into contracts and then not do an awful lot with them. They kind of just trot along, and it's only when it gets to the end and sometimes past the end of the probationary period that employers will think, not sure this person's right for the role, or they're not performing. So tightening up on use of probationary periods is something to think about.
That's a really interesting one, I think, because I've seen it go the other way. I've definitely had conversations with people who say, well, actually, we've just taken probation periods out of our contract. You know, there's a 2 year qualification period at the moment for unfair.
So why bother?
We just don't bother because we
otherwise
kind of sometimes setting ourselves up to fail. And I know there was a debate on LinkedIn ages ago, maybe last year now, in relation to the usefulness. It's probably one of those comments that comes up periodically in some of the HR forums about what's the usefulness of a probation period. Well, they might, you know, next year we might all be saying, yeah, they're super, super useful. Let's dust off your employment contracts and start
getting
really some tight probationary periods, and then start educating your workforce on how to use them as well.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember, I think it was in our first Employment 101 season, Verity and I did a debate on the pros and cons of probationary periods. Yeah. I think I was pro them and she was against them. I can't remember, but if you're interested in looking at that, it's somewhere on our Spotify, somewhere on our website, I'm sure. But it is a big topic. If they're used properly, I think they're great. But it's just a question of using them properly. Somebody's added a question in the box which says, you know, can we have a 2 year probationary period? Well, exactly. You know, it just depends on what the rules are going to look like. I cannot imagine that Labour are going to repeal a 2 year period and then allow for people to circumvent that by going for that, but we'll have to wait and see. We just don't know.
It's a small line, you know, and it's a small line to say in a couple of speeches, but it has massive implications. We'll probably come on when we talk about the extension of limitation periods, about the tribunal system, but it has massive implications, and you do wonder actually what the practical effect of that is going to be. But I mean, I think it is pretty certain, if there is a change of government from blue to red, that what we will be looking at is a reduction of some sort of the 2 year qualifying period, whether it's a year, 6 months.
Didn't they bring it down last time? I think it was Labour that brought it down last time from 2 years to 1 year.
Been 1 year, kind of 20-ish, and then when there was a coalition government, it went up to 2 years. But I'm pretty sure I started practicing, it was 6 months. Or it's been 6 months at some point. A long time ago.
Maybe. Well, from our you know, purely selfish perspective, we also the impact here will be on the employment tribunal system, obviously, because we wrangle with that every day. And for those of you that are in employment tribunal litigation, you will already know how long it takes. I mean, I have been trying now for 3 weeks to get through to the tribunal on the phone to find out whether a hearing in November is going ahead, because the case management order is unclear. They're just underfunded, under-resourced. And if you're going to have people with day one rights, that's automatically going to mean a vast increase on cases. And there's just, the system will just buckle. I don't know how they're going to sort that out, to be absolutely honest, because it's already pretty awful. And that was after the number of cases went down when they repealed the employment tribunal fees. So, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is concerning. You kind of think it's got to go hand in glove with going into the enforcement side, you know, the judicial side.
It'd be interesting to hear from you guys what you think, whether you think that might be a bar on recruitment. If you want to just add into the chat or the Q&A function, whether you think this would make you adjust your thought processes on recruiting people, and, you know, just let us know. Just be interested. Just add your thoughts.
Yeah, would you be more reluctant to hire people if there was a much, much shorter unfair dismissal qualification period, say day one or 3 months perhaps? Yeah. Let's have a look at something else then, another pretty contentious area. I'm just going to launch a poll on this. So by all means, please do have a look at that. Should be up on screen. Banked /casual contracts, 0 hours contracts. Because the headline from Labour is that they are going to ban all 0 hour contracts. And remember, these are things they're saying they're going to do within the first 100 days of a government being formed. 0 hours contract. I mean, there's no real statutory definition of a 0 hours contract. I think there's something referenced in a bit of legislation in relation to exclusivity clauses. But by 0 hours contracts, we're talking about, you know, really flexible contracts with no guarantee of income, no certainty of hours, but covers things like bank contracts as well. Labour saying they're all going to go. The trade unions say, well, the use of 0 hours contracts is a means of abusing vulnerable low-income workers who don't have any job security and they don't have any guaranteed income at all. Flip that over to the business side, and kind of the business case is summarized in one word, which is flexibility. Zero-hour contracts do give a lot of flexibility, and especially in the current kind of uncertain economic climate and bit of a funny climate we're in terms of recruitment as well. It is a means of businesses being able to operate in these uncertain times in a really, really flexible way. I personally don't see 0 hours contracts as being inherently problematic of themselves if they're used in a fair and appropriate way. We've obviously got a ban on exclusivity contracts within them, exclusivity clauses. Of course, there are going to be employers out there who might be tempted to abuse the use of 0 hours contracts. And, you know, I agree that does need looking at. But the concept of them does have its place. The thing with 0 hours contracts is, when you read about them in the media most recently, it's all been around app-based work. So people who are, you know, doing delivery service for the app-based companies, right? But actually, they are really well utilized within the retail industry, within the healthcare sector, within the construction industry as well. So it is more than just, you know, delivery drivers using an app. Thanks for everyone who responded to the poll, by the way. 31% of you use 0 hours or banked hours contracts within your businesses. 69% of you don't. So that's quite a good split, two-thirds and one-third. So clearly there are a lot of you that are using them still, and you might well have to revisit those and other arrangements. So the difficulty with 0 hours contracts, as we know, is the criticisms from the trade union on it. Actually, the current government has legislated to do some things in relation to 0 hours contracts. And the Secretary of State already has the power to enact legislation to clamp down on some of these things. It's just an example of a provision within a law that hasn't been utilised. So the Secretary of State has the power to be able to enact further rules through secondary legislation to limit the use of 0 hours contracts and how they're used, but just hasn't kind of utilised the tools at their disposal for whatever reason. So I'm guessing that if Labour come in and they're true to what they're saying now, it's going to be the case that they will use the existing legal provisions to be able to make the changes that they want. Mm. Okay, I think, Adrian, you're going to talk about the...
Back to employment tribunals. Yeah. So So, Labour ministers have pledged to double the limitation period, which is currently 3 months for most claims, to 6 if they are elected. And it was Annalise Dodds, who's the Shadow Women and Equality Secretary, who proposed the idea at a Labour conference fringe event organised by the Motherhood campaign Pregnant Then Screwed. I'm sure some of you will have heard of that. They've been campaigning particularly furiously to extend the protection period for women that return from maternity leave. But she said that the time limit extension was necessary, in particular to give pregnant women who may have been unfairly dismissed more time to get redress. And I think this is something that's been on the cards for a while, because, I mean, let's face it, most other legal claims have vastly longer limitation periods. I mean, breach of contract claims can be brought in the civil courts for up to 6 years. So I don't know whether this 3 month limitation period is just something that is historic and has just never really been looked at, but it is incredibly short. How's that going to impact? Well, I suppose from our perspective, the types of questions that we might get asked is, if we make somebody redundant, when can we, you know, and we need to rehire, how quickly can we rehire? Now, once upon a time, it was quite easy for us to say, well, it's a 3 month limitation period for them to bring a claim. So, you know, you probably leave it 4 months to enable the tribunal claim to land if there is going to be one. However, now, frankly, and under the current circumstances, it's a lot more difficult to say that, 4 months will be fine, because we just don't know how soon a tribunal claim might land. And, you know, because you've got the ACAS conciliation periods and all the rest of it. So there is that potential knock on for your business planning. Obviously, if there's a settlement agreement signed, then that's different and that nails it down. But, you know, a 6 month period will mean that there is potentially a period of uncertainty before you can all breathe a sigh of relief and go, phew, we're safe. But I do think personally it is quite short. So
there's a practical aspect to that as well, isn't there, in terms of, first of all, how does early conciliation tie in with it? So you've got a kind of tail. And one thing that we encounter is, you know, if we're only aware kind of right at the tail end, so once a claim's gone in, we're saying, well, actually, you're going to need to produce a load of documentation here. So have you got stuff now going back, what, 7, 8 months, potentially 9 months, maybe? What about key witnesses? You know, it's not inconceivable that some of the people who are involved and named in a claim as potential witnesses or perpetrators or actors of the thing complained about could have moved on. You know, they could have retired. Yeah. Another job. How easily are we going to be able to contact them? So there's some practical implications of that. You know, Sina just put a poll up just asking whether or not you think it's a good idea to double that time limit, and it's a pretty even split, I've got to say. 46% of you said no, it's not a good idea, and 46% of you said yes, it is a good idea, and 54% of you said no, it's not a good idea.
Interesting on that point on witnesses, though, and this is, you know, for those of you that have obviously been involved in litigation, you'll know that the sort of the last stage, almost pre-hearing, is the exchange of witness statements. And very often, because if the case might settle, there's not wanting to incur the cost of drafting witness statements quite early on in the claim. So to deal with the point that Peter was just talking about, it may well be that you end up having to front load your case preparation an awful lot more. So you're getting your documents together at an earlier stage, and you're, you know, taking witness evidence from the witnesses at an earlier stage, just in case they do move on. But if you've engaged them earlier on, at least you've got sort of contemporaneous evidence there that you can then go, hey, do you remember when you gave us this witness statement? You're now going to have to turn up. So there is that. That's going to be a potential knock-on effect in terms of costs. But that also might mean that it focuses people's minds to try and get cases settled a lot sooner, so that they don't have to incur those costs. I mean, I'm just sort of thinking creatively here in terms of where the impact might be. But right, let's move on to fire and rehire. So this is a big thing that Labour are absolutely gunning for. And just sort of, I'm sure most of you already know, but it's basically where employment's terminated and then the employer offers new, often less favourable terms. And if the employees don't accept, then there's a dismissal, which is then actionable. And it came into massive focus, hit all the headlines when P&O were very naughty indeed. And that's my polite way of saying it, when they simply fired about 800 staff without any consultation and without notifying the business secretary as required on the HR1. But the current government have already planned for a statutory code on this in terms of outlining some, I think they call it a 9-step plan, but Labour wants to go a big step further forward than that, which is just an outright ban. I think the Lib Dems might want to do that as well, actually, thinking about it. I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, so Labour wants to ban the fire and rehire practice. And, you know, what that means is if you're in a position where you want to sit down with your staff and make changes to their contract and you cannot get their agreement, then potentially you can't, you can't terminate them. So what does that actually mean? Well, it will mean thinking very carefully about what changes you want to implement. It might mean that employers will be finding out that they were better off going down a redundancy route and saying, well, your job as we see it is no longer going to exist. We'll now go into the discussion about suitable alternative employment, for example, and that could be a bringing in changes through the back door. But obviously, you've got to be really careful that it is a genuine redundancy situation. But otherwise, it's about going through, you know, proper consultation process to get employees' consent. But, you know, what employee is going to consent to an adverse change to their contract? So it's going to make life a little tricky, I think. But I'm not a fan of fire and rehire. And for those of you that have come to us for advice, I always say it should be your absolute last ditch resort.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's got its place, but
but it should be. It should be the last resort, yeah, shouldn't it?
It is
I mean, P&O were outrageous. I'm so surprised they got away with it. I really
am.
Yeah,
I mean, the irony of that one, it's not ironic, but the oddity of that situation was the firing part was all their existing workforce, but the rehiring part wasn't their existing workforce. It was a bunch of agency staff, I think, or people from overseas. So,
It
wasn't like they were, as I understand it, I think I'm right in this. It wasn't like they were firing their existing workforce, but saying, hey, look, we're offering you immediate re-engagement on just some slightly different terms. It was, you're all fired, sorry.
You're fired and you're not coming back on any terms.
Yeah, and it was done by Zoom, wasn't it, I think?
I mean, there's been lots of big companies and, you know, some of the sort of really big ex-public sector companies have all been through this type of process, and that's why it's sort of come to the forefront, I think, because it's a practice that it does generally impact a large number of employees and is generally seen to be quite unfair. But
yeah, and while we're talking about P&O, I've had a question saying what sanctions were imposed on P&O because of their shocking behaviour. I don't think there were any sanctions.
No.
Most of the employees, apart from one, signed a settlement agreement. Removed all claims. Their chief exec or managing director, you know, one of their executives from the UK business was hauled in front of a parliamentary select committee and had to explain an approach and why it was taken. So that was no doubt very embarrassing for him. But I'm not sure whether it even affected the contract that was being awarded to the parent company.
Sorry, I was doing my usual. I said yesterday on a call with a client with Peter that he said that he enjoys being interrupted by me, which is just as well because I do it all the time. So I'm just going to apologise again for that. But the thing that annoyed me the most is the fact that everyone panics about submitting the HR1 and making sure that's fine because failure to notify the Secretary of State is meant to be a criminal offence. And yet these guys got away with it. And I just thought it makes a mockery of it.
It does a bit. I mean, thanks for your comment, Paloma, about, you know, the penalty likely being low and fair process. Yeah, really, it is a commercial decision. Someone's done a commercial calculation of, if we take this approach, what's the most cost-effective and fastest way of achieving it? And so it was clearly a calculated decision where they weighed up the cost and, you know, maybe the media backlash as well versus the commercial necessity of making that decision. It's pretty risky, though. I mean, what worked for them was the fact that they managed to get a settlement agreement signed where people waived their employment rights, so they weren't going to get sued by anyone apart from that one person who I think is still going through the tribunal system. That's the unknown quantity. And certainly, you know, the concept of buying your way out of trouble as an employer is absolutely not new. You know, it happens. Yeah. Day in, day out, sometimes for good reason. You know, sometimes employers have been generous, sometimes they're not. But, you know, that's the whole point of the settlement agreement process. Okay, that's the Labour Party position. Before we wrap up, obviously it's fair to look at a couple of the other parties as well. In terms of the Lib Dems, I have to say it's quite difficult to find what they're saying about employment rights apart from a couple of snippets. So, you know, if anybody is a active Lib Dem party member and knows what their policy position is on some of this stuff, then please do let us know, because I am curious to see, and maybe we can do a deeper dive into their ideas. But what we do know is they're saying two things. First of all, giving everyone a new right to flexible working. Quite what that means, we're not entirely sure. Maybe it will mean a day one flexible working right. And secondly, every person with disabilities, the right to work from home as well, I think. Adrienne, have I trod on your toes talking about those two things?
No, not in the slightest. No, I was just going to say, I'll just sort of follow up on that, because in actual fact, under the current government, the Conservative government, on the flexible working, there are changes that are coming into force next year. The Flexible Working Act got Royal Assent this year. Changes normally come in a year after that, and there are minor tweaks, but it's there's going to be secondary legislation that brings that in as a day one right already, rather than waiting for 26 weeks. So just to sort of follow up on that, the decision making period is going to be 2 months rather than three. You've got to consult with the employee before rejecting their request, which, you know, as best practice, that's what you should be doing now anyway. And whereas now an employee can only make one request in a 12-month period, under the new rules, they'll be able to make two. So there's already going to be changes around flexible working anyway. Yeah. Maybe they're aligned in that sense.
In terms of the Tory party, obviously they're the governing party, the Conservative Party. So we know what their plans are, because there's a programme of legislative change that is going through Parliament at the moment. A couple of things that are coming out there, the Predictable Terms Act. So this kind of ties in with the 0 hours piece we were talking about. The Predictable Terms Act, it amends the Employment Rights Act to give workers and agency workers the right to request a predictable work pattern where there's a lack of predictability regarding any part of their work pattern, and fixed term contracts for less than 12 months are assumed to be unpredictable contracts. So people will have a right to request a predictable work pattern. The change relates to their work pattern, and the purpose in applying for the change is to get a more predictable work pattern. So there's legislation going through at the moment. In terms of sanctions there, claims will be possibly based on procedural failings by an employer to deal with the request, unlawful detriment for having made a request, and also automatic unfair dismissal. And the government are basically saying, wait and see what the regulations say, because they'll have further details of the statutory regime that are in there. Just want to pick up on a couple of questions and comments that people have made. Has Labour indicated what the change for the probation period might look like, e.g. 3 months like in Switzerland? No, I haven't seen anything. There's been no comment on that. We'll know that there's no prescribed probation period in English employment law at the moment. So it's not like there's a default of 3 months or 6 months or anything like that. It's entirely done on a employer by employer basis. So thank you for that question. In terms of comments about whether or not day one rights might put you off hiring people, a couple of you said, no, don't think it would stop recruitment, but would make clients take probation periods more seriously. Mm. Rachel, thanks for your comment. Would definitely want to review the probation and recruitment process and how robust the assessments are and how we're leveraging them. I mean, definitely, that's the big risk area.
That's the key.
It's consistency of treatment when it comes to application of probation periods. And we all know that inconsistency of treatment forms the basis of all discrimination claims. So risk areas for me. Elaine says, I think it should make companies better prepared if they don't leave things until the last minute. Definitely. And unfortunately, there are a lot of companies or managers that will leave things to the last minute as well. Is it likely any planned employment law changes will be rowed back on by another party getting into government? Probably just in relation to the more restrictive trade union rights that have come in this year is the most obvious one for me. That's going to be rowed back on. Adrienne, are we wrapping up there?
We've gone. I'm just really sorry that we've gone so far over time, but there's obviously an awful lot to talk about. Hopefully we've given you some food for thought. Hopefully not food for panic, but it'll be interesting times ahead for sure. So thanks ever so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, everybody, and for your questions as well. What I'd say is we're back online in a couple of weeks' time. same time, Thursday at 11, off the top of my head. I know it's really bad, but I can't remember what the topic is, but it's central to our theme of the cost of living and supporting your employees and the impact for HR of the current economic uncertainty. Please look out for our recording. Please look out for our LinkedIn posts as well. As always, we absolutely love any feedback you can give us. So ideas for future sessions, any feedback you want to send through, we will gladly read it. But in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your weeks and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.